at a time when investigative reporting is really under siege at a lot of institutions, not at the Globe, but at others. So I think it was a combination of their pitch and their sincerity and the feeling that they were going to work very hard to make this happen. I think for those reasons we decided to go with it.
Related to that, you know, you guys know that a lot of times movies and television shows kind of are a caricature of what they think we do, what reporters and newsrooms are, and that rings hollow to us. This movie really captured what a day in the life of being a reporter is and what you can accomplish when you have the time and resources. So I think that authenticity, we feel really proud of that.
Looking to the big picture of this film, do you see this as a reminder of what's been so important to print journalism over the years, or sort of a foreshadowing of how scary it is what we're losing because of the way the business is changing?
Hey, can you guys tell us who you are?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Rick Bentley with McClatchy Wire Service.
Okay, yeah.
I'm Courtney Howard with FreshFiction.tv.
Okay, thanks.
Well, we're all concerned about where we are at this time in journalism, newspapers particularly, obviously struggling and laying people off in the internet era, and so we all love the message that the film underscores, which is the importance of good investigative journalism in a democracy and the dangers of not having it.
And not just in a democracy, in the sense that the big institutions that sort of guide the personal lives of people.
Yeah, I think the message here is it's really up to journalists to hold powerful institutions and powerful individuals accountable for what they do. And really think about it, who else is going to do that except for journalists? And I think the movie makes that point this is really an essential part of our society, as Ben said, in a democracy, because without the information that investigative journals provide, how are people going to know the truth about the institutions that are governing large parts of their lives?
And, you know, everybody at this table knows that print journalism is in tough shape, right? And a lot of people have said this may inspire young people to want to become reporters. That's great, but I think what I hope it really does is make people realize you have to support the print journalism industry if you want to have work like this happen. So that means if you don't want it delivered on your doorstep, we hope you get a digital subscription. I mean, that's what's not happening now, that eroding revenue, and I think we have this fantasy that maybe that will be a little burst in subscriptions that helps other newspapers do what we were able to do.
I mean, the writers and the director were talking about that the movie's not, it's not questioning faith, it's just portraying what happened with this specific problem inside the Catholic Church and what's going on still today. But for someone like me that is a non-believer, I see, for example, a scene where a victim says that his mother opened up the door to the priest because it was like God walking into the house. Mm-hmm. So for you, don't you start questioning the real value of having these kind of hierarchies in society where some people is kind of above normal human beings? My name is Nestor from DesertHollywood.com.
I think, religion is, in the end, very personal, and faith is personal. Catholics, were, I think, rocked by the revelations of this story, and it caused them to question their faith and perhaps stop going to church. Others still kept their faith. I think in the end, that's just a very personal decision for people. And
as did Mike and Sasha, we all grew up Catholic. We were raised Catholic. I had 12 years of Catholic education at a time in the 50s and the 60s when the Catholic Church was so interwoven into the lives of our families that we took it for granted that nothing bad could ever happen if you were enveloped in the arms of the church. And for us as even lapsed Catholics to find out that this institution had been responsible for enabling and covering up the rape and sexual molestation of tens of thousands of children by thousands of priests over decades, it's unimaginable that this could happen. And for me, it's shattered my faith in that institution. As Ben said, I have my faith. but not in an institution run by men who are so fallible that they would let this happen.
You know, there will always be bureaucracies and hierarchies, but it's just a matter of making sure that people are always questioning them, holding them to account, right? So whether it's government, nonprofit, corporate, religious, again, it's the reminder of there just has to be people that are asking rigorous questions, because we saw what happens when over decades questions aren't asked.
Angela, please come if you have a mic. Do you think it was much more of an impact because it happened here in the U.S. in a city like Boston? Because in Latin America, we all have grown up with stories, you know? So I was just wondering if you thought that it made more of an impact here in the U.S. because it happened in such a Catholic town.
Well, you know, it happened in such a Catholic town, but in fact, in the United States, there's such a separation between church and state that it was much more likely to come out here as it did, even in as Catholic a town as Boston, than in Latin America, where there is such close ties between the church and the state. And in fact, during our investigation, we met with the owner of a large cable network in Mexico who tried to do a documentary on abuse there, and the church threatened him, the government threatened him, all of his advertisers or many of his advertisers threatened him if he went forward with it, and many of the stations in his network would not carry the documentary.
Yeah, I think the movie is an argument for a strong and independent press, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in many Latin American countries that's lacking. You know, there's a very important moment, I think, in the movie where the Boston Globe editor, Marty Baron, goes to talk to Cardinal Law. Cardinal Law says, I think our institutions function the best when they work together. And Marty says, excuse me, but I think the role of a newspaper is to stand alone. And I think it's a really important point. And I think one of the reasons the story broke in Boston, Massachusetts, is because we had an editor like Marty Baron, and we valued an independent, strong press. And I stress independent.
But obviously, Boston is not the only place where this happened. I mean, we just happened to get into the Archdiocese of Boston's file cabinets, and it's been proven again and again, when you get into the file cabinets of other dioceses, you often see it in other states, other countries. You know, this is a system problem, not a city problem.
Exactly.
Could I ask you a question? What is the view? What is your country?
Oh, I grew up here, but I'm originally from Panama.
What is the view about the problem there, and has there been any reporting on it?
As far as I know, not really. Growing up with priests coming to your home for dinner or for family parties and things like that, you just took it as a norm. Mm. And then you find out later, not so much the priests that came to my family homes, but you find out about priests and nuns and things like that over the years, and you kind of start losing respect or belief in things like, and that's why. When it broke in Boston, I thought to myself and with my mom, we were saying, you know, it's nothing new. It's just that it's larger and it's here in the United States because of the separation of church.
But as the final scene in the movie shows, where they show all the cities outside the United States that have been affected by this, I think there's no question that this has had an enormous ripple effect.
I was really happy to see that.
Yeah.
It's showing that it's not just here, it's everywhere.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, back in 2002, when so many stories were coming out of Boston, because, as Sasha said, we got into the file cabinets of the church, people would ask us questions that were like, well, is there something in the water in Boston that makes the priests want to abuse children? And we say, no, in your diocese, in your city, it's the same rate of abuse. It's just the church has managed to keep it secret. And just as a reminder on the numbers, in the end, we found that close to 10% of the priests in the Boston Archdiocese had been credibly accused of sexually abusing children.
We've also found that in the few dioceses where all the records have been released, the number has also been about 10%. So it does suggest a systemic problem that you would run into in any country.
So we should change the movie. We said 6% in the movie.
Well, that's right. And ultimately, you know, Richard Seip, who was excoriated for suggesting that 6% of priests might act out with minors was not only vindicated, but as a matter of fact, he was underestimating the number significantly.
One of the things, I'm Shaya, I'm with TakePart.com. One of the things that we talked to Josh about when he was talking about sort of developing the movie was that the Boston Globe had been on this story, that there was the news brief about the 20 priests, you know, being accused. And, you know, I worked for the AP for almost 10 years before I joined Take Part, and I can't tell you how many quick, hard, fast stories I churned out about topics that I felt were deeply serious. And you're doing so much. There's not a lot of opportunity a lot of times to dig. He spoke a little bit to this on your behalf, but I was curious to hear in your own words. Do you have regrets, sort of looking back, that it wasn't uncovered sooner? Are there things that you look back on, you know, wishing that had been dug into, or is this sort of just part of the job of being a journalist that's on a daily deadline and pumping things out?
That that particular document about that story, it was actually a full story. It just was not prominently displayed in the paper about the 20 priests. I was the Metro editor at the time. When we found out about it, that story, at least the Herald version of it, which we found during our investigation, we didn't remember it. It was 8 years earlier. But as you know, at a daily newspaper, you get hundreds of phone calls a day. You know, things go flying by you. You get, for every 10 people who say there's a conspiracy against them, you know, nine of them are on their off their meds, and one of them, there really is a conspiracy. And, you know, it's really difficult to sort that out. The one thing I would say is, if we had, I mean, in hindsight, we can all see with all of our stories, you know, gee, I wish I had known that, or if I'd noticed this. If we'd gotten it 3 or 4 years earlier, before the internet age, it wouldn't have gone viral, number one. And number two, this was going on in every archdiocese, and every archdiocese has a major newspaper, and we still got it first, the enormity of the problem. So, you know, yeah, of course, I mean, that's reporting. You know, you sort of, it's two steps forward, one step back, and but in the end, we got it right.
And to emphasize something Robbie said, I mean, it sounds so comical now in this era of digital journalism, but this was the early era of the internet. And again, a few years earlier, our stories would only have been read by people in the radius of the Boston area. They were read all around the country. That meant tip calls came pouring in all around the country, and that benefited our reporting. So the delay, although it's, the movie depicts the sort of our beating ourselves up for it, there was a benefit in the delay.
The narrower story that he alluded to there about, you know, the one that fell between the cracks, that's a separate issue, and it's an example of how journalism, things do fall between the cracks in the chaos of the day. The guy faxed over a list of names, and that comes in amidst 200 or 300 faxes a day, and so that was an example of something that we booted. But your larger question of could we have gone after it earlier is a complicated one, and in fact, this was not an unfamiliar topic to us. Clerical sexual abuse. In the early 90s, we had conducted a big investigation of another bad priest, Father James Porter. And, you know, the difference was that we couldn't get the goods on that. You know, not every story is a home run. Sometimes you hit a single, sometimes you hit a double. And we did good work on that story, but in the final analysis, we couldn't get the internal church documents that we were able to get in the Gagan case, which took that story to a different level. And so I think the movie raises important questions about deference and people, not just the Globe, but others, being aware of a problem, perhaps through scuttlebutt, but never really taking it head on.
In the process of making the film, the actors essentially turned into investigative reporters because they had to study you and question you, and the filmmakers and the scriptwriters had to investigate the story themselves. How difficult was it for you guys to turn off the journalist and become the subjects?
Extremely. I mean, I think I personally was extremely guarded at the beginning. They were asking us very personal questions, like, how did this affect your marriage? And I wondered, once that gets put through the Holly machine, what's that going to look like on screen? Mm-hmm. And I think, again, that's why the end result is so lovely. It has integrity. It's not salacious. It's not over. It's not glamorized. It's not exaggerated. And we saw how hard the actors work behind the scene to be as good as they are, including depicting mannerisms we didn't know we had.
You know, when you think about it, this movie is really amazing because there's no explosions, there's no car chase, there's no nudity, never mind sex, and there isn't a single firearm. And yet, this is a really exciting, thrilling movie that very accurately portrays the substance of what we did. It's almost an act of genius, I think.
I have a question for Sasha, sort of being the woman in the room at that time. These guys all seem like a bunch of fine gentlemen. But I'm wondering if, like, you felt a need to prove yourself. I know that you, in the scene in the movie at least, you have that really spine-chilling scene where you're knocking on the door and shoe leather pays off and the molester answers the door and says, yes, you know, this happened. What was it like being a woman in the newsroom then? And did that sort of ever... you know, cross your mind, or did you have anything to prove for us as lady reporters?
You know, I mean, I think the Globe then and now was pretty good on gender balance, you know, and I didn't think I felt like having anything to prove. I think we felt like equals. You know, I had covered the courthouse, and I knew the legal system really well, so when Robbie was assembling the new team, he sort of was selecting by expertise. Mike had a ton of political work. Matt Carroll had done a lot of database work. I had courts and legal, so it was a good complementary team. I think maybe the one thing I brought as a woman is that a lot of these victims were incredibly embarrassed and humiliated and ashamed by what had happened, and I think it was easier for them to talk to a woman about those things. So I think that might have been one gender advantage in this project.
Yeah. I used to get sent out on a lot of dead kid stories. I felt like that, and that was because I think I was easy to sort of cry to.
Yeah,
in that way.
Exactly.
You know, I'd been an editor for quite a while, thanks to Ben Bradley recruiting me as a city editor a number of years earlier, and I think I developed a fine eye for talented reporters, and when I took over the Spotlight team just a year or so, not even a year before we began our investigation, I was allowed to put together this team, and actually the... It almost doesn't matter what reporting I did on this investigation. The fact that I was able to bring together such talented reporters as Sasha and Mike and Matt Carroll, and that, you know, we talk about the ensemble cast and what a great job they did in this film. We had an ensemble cast of reporters that worked extremely well together. Everybody was selfless and wanting to help everyone else. And when you have four really good reporters, and we were all good reporters, working together, it's like having almost like a fifth brain in the room, you know, where you feed off one another and you give one another tips and helpful suggestions. Well, why didn't you try this? Well, how about that? It makes for a much better reporting in the long run, and that's where we ended up.
And during your Spotlight years, where you feel like this... would make a great cinematic experience as well, like Spotlight 2.
No, we don't think about movies.
Yeah, and we never thought this was going to make a great movie. I mean, if you asked us, we would say, "What? We read court documents. You know, how can this? We assemble databases. We look at church directors. How could this ever be cinematic?"
Well, yeah, I'll tell you, now that they've turned this into something exciting, I'll tell you to think unconventionally. We did what I thought was a great project about private foundations, charitable foundations. They ostensibly exist to do philanthropic good work. We did a project about how really what it's a great way to do is put your kids on the payroll, write off fancy cars, in one case write off an airplane, you know, pay elderly trustees who don't know work a lot of money. It's really a real abuse of the tax code and of the spirit of philanthropy. We read a lot of tax documents. I would tell you, I don't think that's a good movie. Maybe Josh Singer and Todd McCarthy could turn that into a really good journalism story.